Regarding the civilizations of ancient Roman Greece, Nubin Denis Fuzel de Coulanges wrote in 1864, "What we have received from them leads us to believe that we resemble them. We have some difficulty in considering them as foreign nations. It is almost always ourselves that we see in them. Hence springs many errors." From Wyoming Catholic College, this is the After Dinner Scholar, and I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. The ancient city, writes Coulanges, was, in essence, a religious association. The gods of each city, the soil of each city, and the people of each city were unique. Thus, the only civic arrangement conceivable was the city. Dr. Pavlos Papadopoulos uses Coulanges' book, The Ancient City, as a way of bridging the way citizenship was understood in the ancient world of Plato's Athens or Coriolanus's Rome, and how citizenship came to be understood, beginning with Augustine's City of God. I began by asking Dr. Papadopoulos about the characteristics and the benefits of the ancient view of the city.
The ancient city was a small, tightly knit community and a total community. So we get the word politics from polis, which is the Greek word for city, and of course it is something closer to our word for country or nation, but on a very small scale. The great characteristics of it is that it's a total community. It may contain within it several parts, several tribes or demes, as they call them in Athens, but it encompasses everything within that community. Everything is folded into one. That concentration has the great benefit of channeling the energy of ambitious citizens and of normal citizens into concern for the common good of this very small community. You know everyone, or you're only several degrees removed from every other citizen and every other family. Everyone has local ties. There isn't the kind of pulling up stakes and moving around that we're used to in contemporary life. And so there's an enduring investment in your own community. That's a benefit that flows from that concentration. In Greece and in Rome alike, there's also the idea that there is a common forum into which citizens enter and do citizenly things. So if politics is essentially related to speech, everyone can come together into the assembly or to some public space and speak on public matters. And that's tied to the smallness of the ancient city because it's that smallness that enables that kind of direct democracy, or depending on the regime, that kind of direct participation in the public life of the city. It's also worth pointing out, as Coulanges points out, that the city was a religious association. It has its own gods, particular to a specific city. And there isn't a clear separation between church and state, because there isn't a separate institution of church and institution of state. Priests are themselves public officials, and what we would look at as the political leaders often have these religious roles of invoking the gods or performing sacrifices or calling on the right official to perform a sacrifice, take an augury before performing some great matter of state.
Now, did that enhance or inhibit human flourishing?
I think it has to be both. This is a question that I asked to my students when we discussed Coulanges, and I asked it because I think there are good arguments to be made on both sides. I think we naturally today think that such a small, concentrated, and total society, where there isn't as clear a division between public and private, and where there is a geographic constriction, would inhibit human flourishing. It would repress us. We wouldn't be able to express ourselves as freely as we would like, or choose our own way of life. That said, I think that that concentration of life into a small community in which serious matters are taken seriously by all citizens, again, that concentration enables talent. It puts the pressure on to develop talent, and then enables that talent to be put to the common use. And so there's a great concern with excellence, with physical prowess, with excellence in rhetoric, and a great concern that the excellent put their excellences to the common good to the common advantage.
And I would think virtue as well.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That kind of concern, not just physical and intellectual, but also moral excellence or virtue, is a public matter, because the character of a small number of one's neighbors, fellow citizens, will really influence the decisions of the polity as a whole, but in a much more obvious way than in a nation of millions spread across a whole continent.
How did the ancient city pass into other structures?
Well, we see in Herodotus's history, we see the great conflict between the city, the Greek polis, especially Sparta and Athens, and the empire, the Persian Empire. And we also encounter a few other forms, political forms or pseudo-political forms like the tribe and the kingdom of Egypt. But the great political forms that are the protagonists in Herodotus's history of the Persian Wars is the city of Greece, the polis of Greece, and the empire of Persia. The city does not, in the case of any of the Greek cities, the city does not simply transform into, it cannot, it seems, transform into an empire. There are sort of two different, it's not just a difference in scale, but it's a matter of a difference in kind. We see in the history of the Hellenistic period, we see Alexander the Great, who is not from a Greek polis, but is from the Macedonian kingdom, which is already sort of spread out in a way that no Greek city had been. We see him conquer and repress to some extent the Greek cities, and then assume the characteristics of the Persians to some extent in spreading his universal empire. So the great contrast for much of the ancient world is city or empire. How does the one transform into the other? Coulanges gives a great account of how Rome is the one ancient city that could make that transformation, that could leap and grow into something larger than itself and more universal than the other ancient cities. And it does so, in his account, for a very peculiar set of reasons. If the city is a religious association that is by its nature closed off from other communities, even if they're just over the next hill, Rome has the strange fortune of being multiracial, multi-ethnic, multi-religious in a certain sense from its very founding. And so the original core of Rome is already interconnected with countless peoples near it and even far, far from it in Greece from its founding moment. That's very unusual, and that coincidence or providential aspect of the founding of Rome enables it to create relations with its neighboring communities so that it is able to expand and then take them over and subordinate them in a way that Athens or Sparta never could do on a really long-term basis.
Now, how does the advent and the spread of Christianity fit into the story Coulanges tells?
Yeah, Coulanges tells two parallel stories on how the ancient city disappeared, what we would call an intellectual or philosophical development, and then a more strictly historical, political, military development. The second one I'm going to leave aside. That's the Roman conquest of the Mediterranean basis. In addition to that, Coulanges tells of how developments in thought prepared the way for the kind of universalism that we take for granted as Christians. He describes how the rise of philosophy, even before Socrates, the rise of the pre-Socratics and the natural scientists who preceded Socrates, they started to think beyond the bounds of nomos, which is the Greek word for law or custom, beyond the bounds that had circumscribed the ancient city and really the traditions and customs of the ancient city. And so when that's a very disruptive event. The desire to see something universal governing the material world and then also governing the moral sphere. And he attributes to Socrates, I think very accurately, the turn towards what he calls conscience, a sense of duty, a sense of morality, political and ethical questions. And Socrates was the first to start to reason about human things really quite independently of what the customs and laws and traditions of his own city had handed down to him. That winds up being very disruptive and leads Socrates into conflict with Athens. And it's really part of this movement of the Sophists and then the Stoics and other philosophers who follow Socrates. What they were trying to do was look to a standard higher than the standard of their city by which they could judge the adequacy or inadequacy of their own particular traditions. That is what we today would call something like natural law. It's certainly what they called the standard of nature of what is naturally just or naturally right. That prepares for Christianity because there's a parallel in Christianity of the expansion from concern with the chosen people to concern with all people as children of God. And there's a corresponding universalism in Christianity's moral teachings not only that the same thing is right or wrong across the world, it doesn't change from place to place, but everyone has the same obligations insofar as they're humans and made in the image and likeness of God.
Coulange cites the example from Livy's early history of Rome, where the Gauls invaded and completely trashed the city of Rome. And there was a movement to abandon Rome and go down the road to Veii, the city the Gauls left alone, which was much nicer than Rome to begin with. Mm-hmm. And Camillus convinces them to stay by citing the gods, the soil, their families, including the ancestors who were buried there. And that's it. The idea of a move becomes unthinkable. He cited the virtue of piety. What happens to piety in this transition?
Yeah, Camillus's speech, this is at the end of book 5 of Livy, and it's a brilliant end to the arc of the opening of Livy's history of Rome. He calls Rome back to its roots. We use that language of roots, and for the ancients, Roman and Greek, they really had a sense of being rooted in a place. The city was a religious community that had been founded by and in a religious ceremony. The city was not built haphazardly. You start with one building and you build outwards. They actually circumscribed around in the soil a specific place that with religious ceremony within which the city proper would lie. And so there was a sense that to be pious was to be pious to your gods, and those gods were located in a certain place. This included, of course, the family gods who were one's ancestors, one's distant ancestors, who one had little representations of in an altar in your own home. So every home was a small temple to the familial gods of that house. And then every city was a kind of grand temple or religious community to the gods of that city. What happens to piety once you have a universal God who is the creator of the entire universe? Well, there isn't the same kind of intense and religious sanction on remaining in one place in remaining loyal to a place. And so there's a way in which we are uprooted. And of course, the history of the chosen people actually begins with Abraham uprooting himself, being called by God to uproot himself and to go to the promised land. And so Coulange himself sees that there is a kind of similarity between ancient Israel and these ancient cities of Greece and Rome, because there's a specific place that has been given by God to the Israelites. But that same God who gave Israel to the Israelites is also the God who created the entire universe. And with Christianity, that kind of universalism comes to the fore. And so piety all of a sudden is not necessarily dependent upon or does not necessarily instruct you to remain in one place and remain intensely loyal to this community and this location.
It would seem to disrupt a sense of patriotism as well. And I'm thinking of how this relates to our own era, where people say, I'm a citizen of the world. Mm-hmm. Well, it kind of means you're a citizen of nothing. Mm-hmm. You don't have the kind of, at the American founding, mm-hmm. I'm a Virginian first. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm from New Hampshire first. Mm-hmm. That's all gone these days. Mm-hmm. Are we at a loss or is there a balance?
Yeah. So the idea of being a citizen of the world and the sort of nonsensical aspects of that, I think it's interesting to note that that is a secularization of of Christianity, of the universality of Christianity, right? Because, and Augustine gives the classic treatment on this, that we are citizens of the city of man, the city that is on earth, but we're also citizens of the city of God. We all have a kind of dual citizenship in Augustine's presentation. And of course, our membership in the city of God takes precedent over any other association that we have and any other commitment that we have. Of course, the wonderful, beautiful, good, and true thing about the universalization that Christianity brings with it is that, not only is this a truth, but it gives a standard that is higher than the particular, peculiar standard of your own nation. And so there's a kind of control on a sense that there's a higher justice than just whatever your own custom dictates. That said, you could see that there's a kind of weakening of politics and a widespread questioning of politics that is spread by Christianity, by the fact that Christ says, "My kingdom is not of this earth," and by the fact that we no longer identify our earthly fatherland or homeland with our only fatherland or homeland. This is a veil of tears that we are passing through, and there's a kind of temporariness to this commitment once we understand that we are citizens of the city of God. So that, I wouldn't say it quite introduces a tension between one's political loyalty and some higher loyalty. Socrates is a great example of how these extraordinary individuals, these philosophers before Christ, realized that there was and lived out this tension between one's loyalty to the particular and inevitably flawed community that one is born into and something higher, some natural universal standard. But what Christianity does is it all of a sudden universalizes that tension and makes it available to everyone. And so we are left with, we're all in a way living out that tension of being loyal to our own, the nation of our birth and then, or the nation that we've adopted here on earth, and also knowing that we have some higher homeland that we are destined for. And that brings with it these standards by which we must judge the actions of our own customs, our own nation.
Reflecting on what Coulage had to say about the ancient city and the transition from city to empire, I can't help but think of this year's Wyoming School of Catholic Thought, June 6th through 11th, here at Wyoming Catholic College in Lander, Wyoming. Our topic this year is Shakespeare's Rome, and we'll be reading three plays, Coriolanus, set in the days of the Roman Republic when Rome was the kind of ancient city Coulage described, and then Julius Caesar and Antony and Cleopatra, in which Shakespeare reflects on the shift from republic to empire. And I should mention that Dr. Papadopoulos will be one of our professors for the school. For more information or to register, visit our website, wyomingcatholic.edu. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.